The ongoing success of Game of Thrones on TV should prove that there's always an interest in stories from times when people and plumbing were a bit rougher, shall we say, than they are now. Our guest this hour spends a fair amount of time in the Middle Ages, metaphorically. Candace Robb is the author of several books set in medieval England, including a new crime novel with a new main character. Kate Clifford is the star of The Service of the Dead. Her creator, Candace Robb, also goes by Emma Campion. By that name, she's written two historical novels. As Candace Robb, she writes crime novels set in medieval England. So far, there are 10 Owen Archer novels and a trilogy featuring the character Margaret Kerr. Candace lives in Seattle when she is not in England, but she's in Ashland for a couple of events today and Thursday. Candace Robb, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks for asking me. It's fun.
So who is this Emma Campion who writes so much like you?
Well, she was this woman who was looking over my shoulders as I was writing the mysteries and getting curious about some of the actual historic women that I was writing about. And she said, now, hang on a minute. Let's look a little more into their lives. And so I let her take over. And Emma wrote about Alice Perrers and Joan of Kent, Richard II's mother. And she had a pretty good time with that, but I really missed writing the crime, so I took over her life again.
So I imagine in the works when you're talking about true historical figures, you have to delve a lot deeper. You have to get a hold of stuff, and I imagine that is some tricky research.
Well, it's all tricky research, because for the mysteries, I often have historical figures in it. That's how I came across Alice and Joan. But when you're writing about their lives, you have to stick as closely as possible to what we actually know about the women. So I could not change their fates. I couldn't kind of throw in a few extra little adventures for them, and it was really pretty frustrating, I found.
Couldn't leave out the pustules, things like that.
That's right.
You could have been a journalist, it sounds like. What happened along the way to that original dream?
Oh, yeah. I wanted to be a journalist. I actually wanted to cover the Vietnam War.
Wow.
And then that kind of passed by, and I had to switch universities and became an English major out of journalism and fell in love with the Chaucer class I was taking. And that was just it. It changed everything for me. But I did have that good journalism training about deadlines and being succinct.
Ah, so you can when somebody says deliver the book by this date, you can deliver the book by that date.
I do, yeah.
What was the starting point for writing historical fiction versus the non-historical kind?
Well, you know, I just studied Chaucer. I'd studied that period. And when I read history or I listen to history in a class, I'm thinking about the common person and, well, what was this like for them? What would it have been like to actually live in York in the 14th century? What would the streets have been like? And that's what I wanted to pursue. I just wanted almost to create a virtual reality for myself about what life would have been like then and what the challenges would have been and what was similar.
How hard can that be to imagine that when you're looking, for example, at a streetscape of Seattle with electric buses whizzing past you?
Well,
to think about what York was like in 1399.
I'm in York a lot. Mm-hmm. And there's something about York. There are still so many medieval buildings that you can actually imagine. And when I walk through York, it's amazing how much just disappears. And I see, and people will tell me, well, didn't you notice this store on the corner? And I say, no, that's where so-and-so had his tanner's shop. You know, it's just completely.
You can erase centuries with a glance.
I can. It's quite a superpower.
It's a good one to have. I understand that you're writing some science fiction for a while there, and that it was a rejection letter that spurred you to move away from that and into the realm you ended up in?
Well, actually, it was lots of rejection letters. I was writing science fiction stories that had already been written, you know, and I've been told by Vonda McIntyre, who's a great science fiction writer, that every science fiction writer does that at first, and you get that out of your system. But it was actually when I was taking a workshop with Ursula Le Guin. She looked at what I was writing, and she said, you know, the fantasy part and the science fiction part doesn't really pop out at me, but the historical part, that's where you should focus. And when Ursula says something, you do it.
When Ursula K. Le Guin says, let's try this, okay.
Yeah.
Given, you know, wars and fires and all the ways in which memories and records are lost over time, how rich a trove of knowledge do we have on 14th century York?
We fortunately, and it's kind of a mix of fortune and misfortune, we have a lot of records of laws. And the king at one time moved his court and his and most of the royal administration to York in the early 14th century. So we have a lot of detail from that. Some of the actual city records were burnt, and they're right around in kind of a chunk of that period of time that I'm writing in. But you can put it together with what we have from before and after. And York has actually been very, very well documented.
Better than London, for example?
Because No, not better than London, but probably better than Bristol, because Bristol is another big city of the time, and we don't know as much about Bristol.
Hmm. So for the people who do not see much Shakespeare, and I imagine you're going to pick up a play or two while you're in Ashland.
The
story of what's going on in the backdrop of this novel, The Service of the Dead, Richard II versus Henry Bolingbroke, mm-hmm. what's going on between those men and their factions?
Well, you know, they're cousins, and Richard II was, he had a very imperious idea of what a king should be. So he fell out with the barons, his barons, quite regularly. And in my book, I'm also showing how he started losing the favor of the merchants. So he exiled his cousin to kind of really cut it short. He exiled his cousin Henry Bolingbroke while his father, John of Gaunt, Duke of Lancaster, was still alive, most powerful man in England. And he said that you can come back at some point and you will get your inheritance. Well, only months after Henry is exiled, his father dies, and Richard decides, no, I'm going to, you forfeited your inheritance, you stay away, and I'm giving away your lands.
Wow. Okay. Lots of political intrigue, and as it can only be done in medieval style. And I'll tell you something. When you look at the rulers of England, you see this house is out of favor. This house restored then. There, mm-hmm. this house restored a mm-hmm. second time. It's quite an in and out kind of thing. And as we get into the Yorks and the Lancastrians, Yorkists and the Lancastrians, it gets even more detailed than that. Candace Robb, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of several works of historical fiction and historical crime novels. Her latest is called The Service of the Dead. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange to visit more with her. If you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you as well when we come back to the Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Candace Robb, who's written many works of fiction, generally centered in 14th century England around York. Her latest is called The Service of the Dead. It is a crime novel with a new lead character. Kate Clifford is brand new to the constellation of characters that Candace Robb has provided for us. Candace Robb is actually in the studio with me. She'll be in Ashland at an event today at 2 at the library and does a Thursday evening reading at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland. You can join us now as we talk about the creation of historical fiction at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about the Yorkists and the Lancastrians, Richard II versus Henry Bolingbroke in this time in history that is the backdrop for The Service of the Dead. It's really interesting because it's more than just wins and losses in battle. You talked about the support of the barons. It really is a lot about who's backing which person at which time. There's a lot of political intrigue involved in addition to horses and guns and all that stuff.
Right, right. And one of Richard's big mistakes, or Henry's luck, bits of fortune, is that the former Archbishop Arundel was also exiled at the same time, and he's sort of the mastermind behind Henry coming back into England and not just deciding to take back his lands, but to take over the kingship.
So as you go through, I mean, this is stuff that is somewhat peripheral. I mean, does Kate, for example, get directly involved with some of the people who are major players in the intrigue?
She will eventually, mm-hmm. yes, because Archbishop Scroop actually has quite tragic and bloody part to play in about 1405, so I have some years to get to.
So you actually plot us. It sounds like a series of books out in advance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's the fun of it. I wanted to create a character who was a fictional character, but connected to, I have her connected to the Nevilles through her her ex-husband, and they're a big, powerful family. And Clifford, that's her family, and her uncle is very important. He's the Dean of York at the time, but he becomes a bishop, and he's one of the people who actually is at the ceremony crowning Henry II. And so, or Henry IV. So, I have her connected to these very, and some very important people in York, merchants that we know about who were members of Parliament. So we have very detailed biographies of them.
Do you try, though, not to give historians heart attacks as you relate these
things? Oh, yes, yes. And in fact, I'm constantly communicating with historians who are specialists in the period to double check that, you know, what I'm doing is plausible. And sometimes they'll say, well, that's kind of wild, but I really like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, can it be a challenge not to make your characters just a little wiser than their time?
I try not to. I try to use and everything that I use, I've seen somewhere. I've seen in a little story about someone or a history about a particular family. So Kate is a kind of an amalgam of a bunch of different women, you know, the weaponry that she learns and the dogs that she has and the fact that she takes over her husband's business but has another business on the side. I've read that all.
Okay, you called him an ex-husband. He's actually a late husband.
He's a late husband,
okay.
Yes.
He's an ex-person,
yeah,
I guess.
Right, ex-person, yes.
Yowza.
He should have been an ex-husband. But.
Oh, really? Well, so let's get started with Kate Clifford. Give us a little thumbnail sketch of her and who you were trying to create here.
Well, I wanted to create someone who was, well, because of it's going to be a series and I want to be able to carry it on for a while, I wanted her to be young enough. And I wanted a woman who was fairly independent. Widows were probably the most independent women at the period because they had some wealth of their own. I wanted her to have some weaponry experience because that seemed like a lot of fun. So I gave her a background that she was brought up on the Scottish borders, and everyone learned weaponry because there were constant skirmishes between the Scots and the English, and she was on the English side. And then I brought her down to York because of troubles in her family. And she's married off to a merchant who she thinks loves her very much. Once he dies, she finds out that he has had a mistress in Calais where he did a lot of business. And she takes over his two bastard children, loves them as her own. I wanted to really give her this mixture of very determined businesswoman and good with weaponry, but a real heart.
Right, but also stuck in the circumstances of her time.
Exactly. So she just has to make the best of what she's got.
We're talking about Kate Clifford, who's the lead character in Candace Robb's new book, The Service of the Dead. It's a historical crime novel set in 1399 York. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Becca in rural Lane County writes in. She says, I love the medieval period in Europe. I'm the most interested in how the common people lived. I sometimes sit on winter evenings staring at the fire, imagining myself in that time and place.
Oh, how wonderful. That's beautiful. Yes, I think it's really appealing to us to think of those times that had no technology and we were connected face to face with people rather than through the wires.
Yeah, we actually have to talk to the people in the room with us and not just look down at screens and things like that. You mentioned having the power to look back at York in particular and see the things that used to be there, your superpower. how often are you in York, and how well do you know the city now and then?
Well, now I know the city very well, and I have lots of friends there. I mean, I usually stay with friends when I go over there. I, for a long time, I was going every year and staying for about 6 weeks. So I would really begin to feel part of the town and shop like everybody else does and talk to a lot of people. That's where I made so many friends. And now I go once every few years and stay for a couple of weeks and just kind of refresh all of that.
So let's talk about the pleasures of creating and maintaining characters, because you've been through this 10 times, I guess, with Owen Archer and, mm-hmm. and Margaret Kerr. Am I pronouncing her last name correctly?
Carr.
Okay. Sorry. Oh, that's right. Deborah Carr. Sorry. Graham Kerr, Deborah Carr.
Yeah.
Always trip on one of those. So, you know, you're setting somebody up for some revisits. This is a character you're, I guess, in a sense, making a friend out of her. You're going to want to come back and see her again.
Right. And in fact, I think in the first book, one of the most important things that I've learned that you do is create this little community. So she has some very colorful servants living in her household. She has a mother who comes in at the end of the first book who's going to cause trouble for her on and off. I mean, I just, having written the Tenno and Archers and from my readers learning that it's the people, it's the characters that they want to keep returning to and find out what's going to happen in their lives. They want to know how many children Owen and Lucy have eventually and all of that. I really need to build up this wonderful cast, ensemble cast, that then I can, you know, one book is very heavily about one another, you know, but there's always this mystery going on, some crime that Kate has to solve.
Are there crossovers? I mean, does Owen Archer ever run into Kate Clifford on the street or anything like that?
After the first book I just gave over to Kate, but mm-hmm. in the second book I'm beginning to feed it. This is 25 years after the last Owen Archer, the most recent one. I still intend to do some. I'm beginning to feed in people who were much younger in the Owen Archers as adults and see, it's sort of a little game with me about when people will realize, oh, I know who that is.
Is it tough to keep those timelines straight sometimes? Remember, oh, what did I do with this person in the other book?
I think I'm going to go out of my mind, but I think it's a lot of fun.
We're talking again to Candace Robb, the author of The Service of the Dead, a historical crime novel set in 1399 York. You can join us at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. How does Kate Clifford get widowed? And her husband's name was Neville. She never took his name. Is that
right.
highly unusual for 14th century?
No, it actually isn't. It isn't until 15th century and later that it's almost accepted that you take your husband's name. Up until that time, it actually was a decision. And many, many women didn't for various reasons. And so
if they came from an important family.
Mm-hmm. Particularly, she was very proud of the Clifford name, and so she didn't take it. And he dies of a fever. But she, there may be in the future a little question about how he actually died.
Really?
Yeah, I left that one open.
He got helped along, perhaps?
I left that one open.
Interesting. So are the circumstances developed in this book, or is it something you're
waiting
for?
No, that will be, yeah, that's kind of a little treat that I tucked away for myself.
As we deal with characters in this time in history, you know, with death and remarriage and mixed families and all that sort of thing, family trees could be very complicated back then.
Very, very complicated. And I think I'm going to start doing a family tree for this book because the Nevilles, particularly that she's involved with, become very important in Henry IV's administration, Ralph Neville, the Earl of Westmoreland. So you really need to understand that she's married to someone she was widowed. She's the widow of someone who is in a very small branch of the family, but there are all these other Nevilles, and same with Cliffords. And I think it's important for people to be able to look at that, and it's very complicated.
How tricky would it have been for a woman of Kate's circumstances to do the things she does here, which is take over her husband's old business, and she rents out space in one of her buildings for travelers, is that right?
Well, it's for travelers, and it's also for wealthy merchants of the city to have trysts with their mistresses.
Assignations?
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
And the reason that I wanted to do that is because then she has everybody's secrets.
Uh-huh.
She has something on all these people, and that's where I give her her superpower.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Because she's a businesswoman. She knows what's going on with many, many very important merchants of York. And they're careful with her.
Ah, okay. So this explains how she's able to navigate what is, I'm sure, a testosterone-drenched world.
Yes, yes.
There are some really fun images in here. You point out that snow was glorious in the countryside, a nightmare in the city.
Yeah.
How can snow be a nightmare in the city? Although then I start thinking about the things that exist in the streets
at
the time.
Yeah, I mean, you have to think about all the garbage and the refuse. And they tried to be actually, medieval cities were much cleaner than most people think they were. But when it snowed, everything is just covered up. And you see that in cities to date as well. As it melts in New York City, you suddenly see all this stuff and the smell rises and it's
especially when the snow turns black in New York City.
Pristine snow is wonderful, but not city snow.
No, there are some other fun images here too, like Kate imagining her brother-in-law dead in the snow. What's up with that relationship?
Oh well, he's sort of the odious. I always think back to one of Trollope's books, and there was this odious Snope, who was a character that you just love to hate. And he's my character, Lionel Neville, that you love to hate. He's kind of a Slytherin, and he wants the business. If she her husband's will is that if she remarries, Lionel gets the business.
Ah, because so now she's got other means. But right. While she's having to support herself, Lionel doesn't get it.
Right. And he's a terrible business person. She's a really good business person. She keeps him in line and he hates it.
It's interesting how you're able to set up those characters, though. I mean, the really first discussion they have in the book is over something missing. Mm-hmm. From a shipment, a little box of cinnamon or mm-hmm. something. But this is how good her sense of business is. And he's like, I don't know. And she suspects him of stealing it.
Right. Because, you know, she has this history with him. I mean, he's the one who dumped the two children on her doorstep and was very cruel about them in their hearing. So it sets up a very difficult situation for her right at the beginning. And she is keeping very careful records. She's got a bookkeeper who's keeping very careful records. And Lionel is just sort of casual about it for a purpose mm-hmm. so that he can siphon some stuff off.
Well, obviously you can't have a crime novel without a crime, so somebody does end up dead, but it's not Lionel, darn it.
No, I have to keep him around because he's a problem.
Of course, you have to have the antagonist there. So who is the person who ends up stiff?
Oh, well, he's kind of a mystery because he's a guest in her, an unwelcome guest in her guest house, not the person that she had expected that night. And he seems to have two identities. He seems to be a spy for both Richard II and for Henry Bolingbroke. So right there, you know, with that murder in her guest house, she's trying to figure out, who is this person and who killed him?
So the pathways of power cross literally right there in her guest house.
Right, and she is very worried about this because who knows who's going to come looking for this man?
I'm always curious about how much time a writer spends on a particular set piece, and the discovery of the body seems to have a lot of care in it because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's gross and it's grisly. I mean, somebody just gotten choked with a bed curtain cord or something along those lines. Yeah. But it's funny, too, because it takes Griselda, the old lady, a while to suss out exactly what she's seeing.
Yeah, she doesn't know that he's dead and she's trying to get the cord out. Yeah, and, you know, those are the kinds of scenes that actually get written very fast because this character, this woman just becomes, I can just see her very upset that, you know, someone is still there in this room and she has to clean this room and then she can't move him and oh my gosh, you know, something's happened to him and she's going to save him and then she's got to tell herself he's dead. Stop this. Just go get your mistress, you know. And I just felt that whole business happening.
And Griselda is not at the best of health herself. And so
no.
she's kind of overcome by, you know, the vapors or something. And plus doesn't really have the strength to deal with this herself.
No.
Physically.
I mean, he's a very big man. I mean, it winds up that he's some sort of assassin. So,
Candace Robb, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, her latest novel, The Service of the Dead, Kate Neville, the lead character. It is a crime novel set in 1399 York. What does Kate Clifford think this event will do to her?
She's worried that it's going to destroy her business and the trust. What's so crucial about her business is that these wealthy merchants and their mistresses, because many of the women are very prominent, feel safe. They feel it's very discreet, that no one's going to find out that this couple is together. And if there's this huge investigation because some royal messenger has been murdered in your house, it just ruins Kate. And what Kate is using this guest house to raise more money outside the business that will be her money so that she'll eventually be independent.
So I know at this point in history, in 1399, death was pretty common, infant mortality very high, life expectancy very low. This is within 150 years of Black Death, isn't it?
Oh, it's much closer than that. I mean, because, let's see, I think in 64, 1364, the Black Death returned to
York. Okay, so actually within 40 years.
Oh, yeah. Within the memory of many people.
All right, so having established that death is pretty common back then, though, what about murders, though? And I mean, we think in terms of, like, you know, what happened is you call the police, they come, they look at the body, nobody touches anything, blah, blah, blah. What was the general procedure back then?
Oh, and at this period of time, you have to, if you find a body, you have to raise the hue and cry. And then the coroner comes. And the coroner is not a forensic scientist at the time. He is simply a bureaucrat who is going to register that this person died, where they died, and apparently what they died of, and who found them. And the person who found them actually has to pay a finder's fee to promise to remain in the area until the actual murderer is found. And that seems very backwards to us.
But, so they're actually paying, it's like a guarantee that they'll stay in town. It's almost like bail, almost.
Yeah.
For the person who found the body.
For the person who found the body. Because so often I'm thinking, I haven't actually found an article that says this is how they came up with this, but I would guess it's because so often that is the murderer.
Wow. Back with more of the highlights of 14th century criminology when we come back and talk more with Candace Robb about her book, The Service of the Dead. And, of course, she's written all those, the 10 Owen Archer novels and the trilogy with Margaret Carr. So back on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about writing historical fiction with Candace Robb, or Emma Campion, as you may know her from her other books. Join us on the Exchange when we return in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, our final segment today, in fact. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Candace Robb, who is a prolific writer of fiction, historical fiction and historical crime novels, set generally in York in the 14th century. Her latest is called The Service of the Dead. It features a new character in her progressions of crime novels. This one is Kate Clifford. This follows 10 Owen Archer novels and a trilogy with Margaret Carr. You can actually see and hear Candace Robb in person today at 2 at the Ashland Library and Thursday night at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland, or join our conversation now, 800-838-3760 to talk about the books or the process of writing, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So Kate Clifford, pretty tough character, widowed. Got some archery skills, so she knows weaponry. So she's got some martial skills here. Good head for business, is managing some things to bring money in since the death of her bumpkin husband. Who else lives? I mean, we mentioned, too, that the bastard children she's taking care of, the ne'er-do-well brother-in-law Lionel. Who else is in the immediate orbit around Kate, this motley crew?
Well, she has an interesting cook who is a former assassin. And he has found his peace in cooking for a family. And he is missing some fingers and one ear. And he's this big, burly guy. And a lot of my friends who read the book before it got published just fell in love with Berend. They thought he was just terrific. And I thought, oh, really? And he's sort of her confidant and the person she depends on a lot for kind of tossing ideas around, and he's also a great bodyguard, although she does have these two Irish wolfhounds, Leal and Gaunt, who are very, very well trained, and they're always with her, and they get into the action toward the end of the book. They're quite good warriors on their own. And then she also has Janet, who is her serving maid, who she caught trying to steal from her one night and decided, this woman must have an interesting story, and she gave her a job.
Really? So Kate's response to somebody trying to do her wrong is to bring them under her wing.
Well, she gets really curious about them. What are you about, and what do you know? And she realizes that this young woman really knows her way around York. She probably knows everybody in York. She would be a great person to have on her own side.
So Kate is wily, clearly, and has some ability to navigate intrigue, and certainly has some things she can hold over people in positions of power. Mm-hmm. Does she have a dark streak as well, or is she generally pretty pure of heart, would you say?
She has a dark streak in that whenever anything is dangerous for anyone she loves, she's going to go after that person. She's going to protect them. And so she can get kind of wild and maybe overreact. She's also very determined to stay independent. And so I don't know that I'd call that a dark streak. I think that that's just a strength with her. But her darkness is also all the death in her family, with the skirmishes with the Scots, and just memories of all of this darkness.
How delicate a balance to portray this time in history, not necessarily for the characters, but for the surroundings. I mean, I can imagine you want us to be impressed with the architecture of York, impressed with the clothing perhaps, but probably some much with the pustules and the bad teeth and the horrible smells in the streets and that sort of thing.
I kind of try to make it, I always write from the point of view of one of the characters in the book, so they're not going to notice this is dirtier than usual. So I have to get that across in a way that would be just they're going about their ordinary life and noticing this. So some of it isn't quite as emphasized as it might be, because it's just part of life at the time. So,
well, actually, one of the reasons I ask this is because I think in terms of the things that would shock people from 1399, standing in 2016 United States, you know, cars whizzing by at high rates of speed, that sort mm-hmm. of thing, but that they wouldn't notice also the clop-clop of horses coming near them necessarily, because they'd screen it out kind of the way
right.
we do.
Right.
And actually, there's a bit of an accident in the beginning of the book.
Right.
Involving
there's
somebody.
A wagon.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a wagon at the beginning of the book, and that's one thing that is very common in medieval York, is the narrow streets and merchants coming through, people congregating on the streets, children playing on the streets, these very narrow streets. If a horse got spooked, so many, you were really supposed to walk your horses through the town, the city. But if they got spooked, terrible, horrible things happened. I mean, children were crushed, people were run over, the wagons went everywhere and smashed into buildings, and some of the buildings weren't that strong, so they could go right through them.
Wow.
I mean, you hear about this all the time, and that's, you learn about it through the laws that they had, that you were supposed to walk the horse through the city, and in fact, they preferred that you didn't have the horse attached to the wagon, but that people were walking the wagon through the city.
Wow.
So it happened very quickly. I mean, this is a spot where they've just come through the gate mm-hmm. of the city, and it happens very fast.
How much of Old York is more or less intact? I mean, is there an old section where the streets are still that narrow, the houses still that close together, and they date back hundreds of years?
Yeah, well, there's the Shambles, which was the old butcher area, and you can almost reach out and touch in some places each side of the street. So you can get very narrow, small cars, smart cars, mm-hmm. down that street, but not much else. And there are other streets that are there. Goodrum Gate still has some of the medieval tithing houses there. And so there are a few places. And then there's still the walls around the city. So you can time, like, how long it takes to go from one end of the city to the other. You do it on something like Christmas Day when everybody's at church and no one's on the street.
Uh-huh.
And you can race around the city and time how long it would take you to get from one place to the other. So you can get a really pretty good idea.
How big was the gated the walled part of the city?
Oh, I'm not very good at the...
How long in time, then, I guess?
You could get from one end of the city to the other if you were running in about an hour.
Oh, okay. So not insignificant.
Not
size,
insignificant,
then.
Mm-hmm. No.
What have been some of the key discoveries or things that you've uncovered or just gotten from your research on your trips to UK? I mean, in other words, I imagine there have been quite a few significant moments where you went, oh, my goodness, I've got to put this in the next book.
Well, I think that some of the interesting things are that York has so many layers of history. So we have this whole community of Norsemen and the Danes who were living in York, and they have found all sorts of...
I heard just recently you call them Norsemen when they're peaceful, and you call them Vikings when they attack.
that's probably about right. But they were actually residents of Yorkvik, which is what it was called then, and we have lots of remains of them, and so that's, of course, why they created the Yorkvik Viking Center, and you can go underneath and take these little cars and go around and smell it and see it. And another one is how large St. Leonard's Hospital was. They keep finding more little bits of it under the streets, so that it was this huge community. And then you start learning that, you know, there was this church that used to be here that was taken away, and, you know, it's no longer exists because they were moving, they were trying to build more of the Minster, and they had to take down St. Mary ad Volvus. And so there was this church there at one time. You have to figure out when it was there and when you have to say that now they're dismantling it. They're forever learning. I mean, it's a constant learning in York about what was there and where it was and who owned it. And so my understanding of the city is constantly changing. There is this big area that that they used to leave the pageant wagons on because they did the York mystery plays. Well, in the second book in this series, I learned that when the soldiers came in to defend the city, their huge camp was on this green right by the Dominican Friary. And you had this huge war camp right inside the city walls around two abbeys, you know, and it's kind of amazing to think of how crowded they were.
The process of writing, I'm curious now that you mentioned the second book, how far along are you in the next, Kate?
Oh, my editor has it. I'm working on the third.
Okay. Are there times when you're writing along and you think, well, okay, this is good, but I think it belongs actually in number three, and you shove it off to the side? I mean, does it get to that point?
You just write
chunks of stuff ahead of time,
yeah,
accidentally?
Yeah, and you just realize that there was a whole lot about Kate's mother in this first book, and then I decided I really need... There was such, what was going on with Kate really needed to stay with her and just get that emotional impetus up. So I just let her mother come in toward the end of the book. And then the second book actually became a large part of it, what I was thinking of I could also have time for in the first book, but it just didn't turn out that way.
Candace Robb is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest novel is The Service of the Dead. Do you ever get into push-come-to-shove kinds of things where for a dramatic device you need something to happen, but based on historical research you know it didn't?
It's happened. So far it hasn't happened with Kate, and I think maybe I've learned to plan a little more. But with the Owen Archers, I really wanted the Archbishop of York to also still be Lord Chancellor of England at the beginning. So I extended his
reign,
for quite a number of years.
A little extension first.
Yeah. I also really wanted to let him live a little bit longer, but the 10th book actually had to be his death. The Archbishop, and it was very sad.
Well, I noticed that on your blog and some of the responses there that fans are asking when are you going to bring back Owen Archer.
Yes.
They can't. 10 books wasn't enough.
It wasn't. They became so attached, and so did I. I mean, I still think of him all the time. They just want more stories. They want to know, well, what happens to him after the Archbishop? Because the Archbishop was sort of his patron, but also his nemesis. Mm-hmm. And then when the Archbishop dies, he realizes he really misses him.
Oops, yeah, I kind of needed my patron there.
So what happens now?
All right, so you did say that there'll likely be another Owen Archer
at some
point?
I'm thinking, yeah. Mm-hmm. I actually have about a third of one written.
Mm-hmm. And how about Margaret Carr?
I don't know. They were set in Edinburgh and Perth and Stirling during the beginning of the Wars of Independence, and it's a real shift to go back to. I used a lot of Scottish terms, mm-hmm, in it, so I was very steeped in Scotland at the time. It would take a lot of shift to go back to those, although I did have a good story going with her.
You seem to keep the dialogue pretty straight. Nobody, mm-hmm, sounds too Yorkshire alike, and I don't,
yeah,
even know if the accent would have been even similar to what it is now.
We don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, except that I do have a character in the Owen Archers who uses the these and the thous, Magda Digby, because when I used to do a lot of radio in England, whenever I would be interviewed in like Sheffield and York, I would get the these and the thous from them because they thought that was so funny that, you know, I understood that and I could respond to that. And they said that there are still people in the countryside who use that language.
Wow.
It was just part of the northern dialect.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I remember, well, Yorkshire, you think of the outs and the nouts and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Now, anyway.
And it's such a great accent, but we really don't. I mean, it wouldn't have been, I couldn't write what they spoke then because nobody would understand it. I'd have a readership of maybe 20.
All the linguists would be reading your books. Yeah. I always have to ask this about the publishing industry and its fate. I mean, and whether you're surprised your success. You've gotten so many books published at a time in history when, you know, the death of the publishing industry sounds like it'll happen in 5 minutes.
Well, it's interesting. Just recently, all the Owen Archers were reissued by Diversion, which is a very new publisher who really came in with the idea of reissuing books that had never come out in e-books. But then they started also printing paper books, and they're now publishing, you know, original work and not just reissuing. And they have more of a it's more of a partnership with the author. It's a very different setup than with a traditional publisher like Pegasus, who's publishing the Kate Cliffords. But it's very exciting to experience this new way. We all cooperate a lot. We do a lot of publicity together. And I think that if you can kind of figure out how things are going and have an agent who is really on top of all the shifts, mm-hmm. it's kind of an exciting time.
Huh. You've certainly found a genre and a niche. I mean, 14th century York and people getting killed seems to be working for you.
Yeah, it really works for me.
Do you think you'd try another genre at some point? Or is it...
I'd like to write fantasy sometime, mm-hmm. but I don't know if I'll have time.
Pretty busy. Certainly if the second book in the series is already at the publisher. The Service of the Dead is the first book in the Kate Clifford series from Candace Robb. You may also know her work as Emma Campion. Either way, she'll be at the Ashland Library today at 2, Bloomsbury Books on Thursday evening. Thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson
Thanks for
Exchange.
Me.
Pleasure.